Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello and welcome to Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I'm not at the Leicester Square Theatre right now. I'm here in the nerve centre of my office. This is where all my crazy ideas come from. That's not where I get them from. It's where they come to, and then I write them down on the computer that I'm currently talking to you via. That's how it works, but I can't tell you where they come from. I can just tell you where they arrive, and it is here. This week's episode is sponsored by DeVille Film. DeVille Film make fab films from broadcast and music videos, documentaries, adverts, corporate projects, or a lovely little online promo for that independent coffee shop you run with a marvellous selection of cakes. I think that's just an example. I think they'll do it for any business you have. They've been very specific there. I don't run a coffee shop. Can I use them? Yes, you can. They've made a list. They've made a mistake of making a list. They'll do a film of any kind for anyone. Not that kind. You disgust me. We'll make the most of your budget and even buy the first round in the pub, probably. Go to www.devillefilm.com. Drop us a line today. Start in your message with the code RAHULASTAPA to receive 10% off your film with us. Not bad, eh? What else do you want? The moon on a stick? Don't forget, also, you can come to the Leicester Square Theatre to see me performing my run of 12 shows. You've missed the first two, but this weekend, like it's mentioned there, 12 shows, August the 7th. The second weekend is 12 Tasks of Hercules Terrace and something like Jogger. They go on, go to leicestersquaretheatre.com or richterring.com, and you can read all about those. Do come along and support me. If you can, support DeVille Film. They've been fantastic, and they have brought you, along with the people who contributed to the Kickstarter campaign, they have brought you this episode of Rahulastapa.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who plans to build a dry stone wall during this show. It's Richard Herring! Wow, God! They're so much better than the cunts we had in last week. They were awful!
They were terrible people. So welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast, or as some of the cool kids are calling it, Rehearlstapa. It's lovely to be here. I promised this audience that I would give away. We had these mugs, so the Rehearlstapa. Good, well done. Andy McH was first in, as you'd expect. These are made for the Kickstarter campaign, so thank you very much to everyone who paid enough to get one of these. They have been sent out already. The rest of the stuff is in the post. It should be with you by now, God would hope, but it's taken me a long time to make the T-shirts. I've got to draw around my hand, I think, 900 times. I haven't started doing that yet. I don't know how long that will take. There's a very good chance I won't write my new show or learn any of the other shows because I'm drawing my own hand on a piece of card. I have to wait for the special bits of card. They're going to be very special. But we made 99 of these, and only about 50 of them were given out to Kickstarter. So we're selling them at the theatres. And as I was saying to the people here, these will be worth a lot of money on eBay, because a lot of you out there will be jealous of it. Says hot drink for a cool kid on there. Very good. So I'm going to give one of these away free. I have a question for the audience. The first person who gives the correct answer will win this literally priceless mug. It's priceless. What day is International Wazzock Day? Pardon?
Wednesday.
No. 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 Even Andy McH says, it is March 9th. I don't think if you can have a second answer. I'll give it to Andy McH. It only seems fair. March the 9th. I thought there'd be some Richard Herring fans in. I was wrong. There he is. Look. How happy are you with that? I bet you've got one anyway, haven't you? Yeah. The worst possible thing. worst person it could have gone to, but you could put that one on eBay. Oh, you've got some friends you could give that to. You haven't got any. No, I'm forgetting it's Andy McH. He hasn't got any friends. Are you friends with Andy McH?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know him, Andy? Yeah, okay, that's all right. Yeah. I just thought it was a guy who's going, yeah, I'll give it a go. Okay, he seems like a nice guy. Look at that. You wouldn't want to be friends with this guy. Look at him. What's your name?
Twan.
Oh, I know you from off of Twitter. I always imagined you were a woman. Oh, you could be. I don't know. Well, are you? If you are, you might be a woman, and then I've made a terrible faux pas. But you're a pretty ugly woman, but a very attractive man. Nice to meet you. I'm slightly scared of Twan. So what do you do for a living, Twan? You're a business analyst, yeah, get a few of those in. Any what's the best business you've ever analysed?
Probably my dog's.
Your dog's business is good. Look at that. Look at, I just want the people at home to see how happy he was with that joke. It's probably his dog's business. Business like poo. It's good. Even the audience are funny. Even the audience are funny. So the next day, when I was away for the weekend when we recorded this, it was last weekend now, and we went to Tring, had a day. My daughter's usually a very good sleeper, but she didn't sleep at all. Well, I got too drunk after this play that I went to see, and of my own play, and I didn't. I had about 1 hour sleep, so that wasn't good. My wife managed to go swimming, and then we said, oh, this hasn't been very good. It hasn't really worked out here in this hotel where they're accusing us of flushing nappies down the toilet. So we said we'd go to the station and maybe have a coffee at the station and in the town. But the Tring station is a mile and a half out of Tring, which is very inconvenient if you live in Tring, and there's nothing there. My wife needed to go to the toilet. There was no toilet. There was nowhere to have a coffee. And there's 5 minutes to the next train, so we thought, well, we'll just put you on the train, and then you can go home, and I'll come home later. I looked at the thing of platform 3, and we had to carry the pram down these big steps, and we got it down there. That's good. And we got down there, and I looked at it and said, oh, it says this train's going to Milton Keynes. That seems to be the wrong direction. And it turned out we were on the wrong platform, and then watched our train pulling away, and then had to walk back the mile back to the hotel. because my wife needed the toilet. There was nowhere to go to the toilet. And with this, it was quite a bad weekend, all in all. And I said to my wife, you know, I know this hasn't been a very successful romantic weekend, what with us not getting here, me forgetting that we had a child, being accused of flushing nappies down the toilet and having no fun. But, you know, we should be laughing about this kind of thing. Didn't find it very funny, but hopefully by now she will do. So will you please welcome my guest for today? I nearly forgot to do this. I just did this very quickly backstage. He's probably best known as one of the writers of the film Razzle Dazzle. That's why That is why we're all here tonight, to see. It seems like I've made a good choice. Will you please welcome, it's Robin Inch, ladies and gentlemen. Robin Inch. Come in. Sit down, Robin. There you have to sit there. Use that microphone.
Razzle Dazzle was actually quite big in Turkey, so fuck you, Richard Herring. There were many posters around the London Underground, but unfortunately Sony, the releasing company, forgot to actually put it in cinemas in London.
What was it? I don't remember Razzle Dazzle.
Oh, I'm very surprised. You're obviously not a fan of that particular genre. It was Ben Miller starred in it, yeah. And it was about a choreographer who teaches a group of kind of 10 to 12 year olds, and he wants to be the greatest choreographer, but he also wants to change the world, and so he does choreography about animal experimentation and stuff like that, and they all have to imagine their rabbits being tortured. And then there's a very keen mother who really wants her daughter to be famous around the world, and she says, if I have to dye her black, I have to dye her black. We might have to do that for the American market. So it's that kind of film. Yeah. So you can see why it went with the Turkish market, but not so big in the rest of the world.
How did you get involved in writing that? Was it your idea?
I'd been writing a movie about wrestling. I've been writing a film about wrestling with my friend Darren, and we'd finished writing the film about wrestling, which it turns out we hadn't, and his wife had written a very a short story, like a page and a half story, about where you think you're basically in the mind of a child who is in a dance competition, and then realise that in fact it's a mother who, when her child fell on stage, got up and just joined in with all the children while they're terrified of this kind of dance. And I said that would make a good film for the Turkish market, and so that's. But it's, do you know what? Of things I've done, I'm not actually ashamed of it. I've only watched it like twice, yeah. But I'm not ashamed of it. And that is a pretty high level in terms of someone with my self-loathing.
Is it on Netflix or Amazon Prime?
Well, I don't know if anyone here knows what the biggest film channel is in the UK. Of course, Movie Mix. Yeah, it's...
it's on Movie Mix channel.
Yeah, recently it was on the 4 a.m. slot, so... and repeated at 11 a.m. as well, so very much for postal workers.
If we can get every single person who listens to this to watch it, could be 100,000 people could watch it.
It's all right. I think it's all right. It's not about... And Ben Miller's tremendously good. The one thing we found out, we had a brilliant choreographer, the choreographer who also did Strictly Ballroom and all Baz Luhrmann's films, and we had various members of the Strictly Ballroom cast in it as well, Paul Mercurio and stuff, and what we realised was you can't teach someone who is not a dancer how to be the greatest dancer in Australia in 4 weeks. So a lot of the scenes where Ben Miller did some really amazing dancing that was beyond any imagination, we did have to cut those. We slightly overstepped the mark, going, I imagine he can be turned into the greatest dancer in Australia in 4 weeks. We'll cut the tap dancing. But he was brilliant. Yeah. Ben Miller was absolutely fantastic.
Well, everyone who's listening or watching, if they, just the day this comes out, if they could go to Amazon or whatever site they want to and buy the DVD...
Not going to be it's either going to be one of those ones that is available for 50 pence or there's two copies that are available for like £98. It's much like Donna Stell's autobiography.
Yeah, so, well, have you I'd love to read Donna Stell's autobiography. Have you got a copy of it?
Yeah, but I'm not lending it. It's gold.
It is gold.
It ain't half hot mum gold. It is an amazing book. I know Arthur Smith's read it as well, and I can't remember. And it was called Sing Lofty Sing, Thoughts of a Gemini, published by the Donna Stell Publishing Company. And it was my favourite book when I used to do the book club show where I'd read out from kind of weird books, because it's written in this style as if basically Donna Stell, he sits down and goes, it's chapter 3 now, about when I first met Windsor Davis. I'm in a very good mood. I'll have a little glass of wine, though, I think. Yeah, it was lovely meeting Windsor Davis. Have another glass of wine. But I want to do another advert for chocolate bars, but Windsor wasn't up for him. A little bit angry about that. And then by the time he's finished the chapter and finished the bottle of wine, everyone's a shit in show business. I sell cassettes in supermarkets while I stand in my pith helmet. Fuck a lot of you. And he repeats it himself a lot, so the three times he goes, I always remember when I worked with Jim Davidson, and you think, yeah, so do we. It was in chapter 2, 7 and 9. But it's It's really worth reading because it's a great warning about show business and why we should never have gone into it. Because he does this thing. Sorry, I told you I was really tired all day, and now you're the first people I've met, and I'm beginning to show off. So it's. But what is great about the book is there's very little about all of the showbiz things he did, and a great deal about trouble he had with his neighbours over the gravelling of a drive and problems with a gate. So it's really, and it does kind of, it is almost, you know, somewhere between Tristram Shandy and Diary of a Nobody.
Yeah, that's why I've read about it somewhere. Someone wrote a fantastic blog about it. I met Don Estelle in Woolworths in doing selling his CD, his cassettes. It was that long ago, and we just were all. I mean, it is all about show business. It's all about how you cope with the success and it going away, I suppose. And Don Estelle didn't cope with it very well, in that he carried on doing his singing and wearing. It is just standing in Woolworths in Western Supermare wearing a pith helmet. And I'm pretty sure we I've got a photo. We all went and just took the piss out of him. And I'm pretty sure we just got a photo of him going like that to us. He certainly did that to us. I don't know if I'm imagining the photo, but we did. We were unpleasant to him.
It is really sad in a lot of ways, because it is, you know, he had these years with It Ain't Half Hot Mum, and then Windsor Davis, it turns out, you know, was a better actor. Don, it turned out, was limited in terms of, do you own the pith helmet? Yep, we got a part for you. So it's like that kind of problem where it was more about the costume necessarily than his performance. Yeah. But it is, yeah, it's a sad book, and I feel bad now in many ways of being derisory about it. Oh. I've heard it was quite big in Turkey.
The book club show came out of you punching a melon representing the head of Vernon Kay. Is that correct?
This was about, what would this be, 2004, I think. And this is, because I listened to your Mark Watson recording.
From last week, yeah.
put it out in that order. Yeah. And but when you said you've looked back, because you're doing all your old stand-up shows, and you go, yeah, many of these were great. I am very lucky, because my first 13 years, I've looked back, and they were awful. So there's no bit of me going, I was robbed. There's me going, I somehow managed to survive. They're really terrible. But that first show that I thought wasn't bad, but a lot of other people were not like-minded on that, was the title was The Award-Winning Robin Ince, Star of The Office, Series 1, Episode 5, First Bit, right? I have a very small part in The Office where I play a guy called Stuart Foote who's having a job interview. And I thought, it came around from, I was with Danny Wallace in a bar, and we were looking at the Fringe brochure, and just everyone, it's, you know, BAFTA Award-winning, 5 times Emmy Award-winning, and we were looking at this, and we were going, well, these people haven't won all these things. They might have been partly involved with things that have won those, but unless you've actually got the award, you haven't won the award. So we started to calculate that if you just, you know, we were at touching distance of these TV and radio things, what our awards were. So it was going to be this whole thing about this guy who, which was me, but me, you know, believing that my work writing on the Brian Connolly show was, you know, masterful. The fact that I did a musical with Sue Pollard, you know, what I taught her about. So this is all true, by the way. I really did do these things. And, you know, working with Claudia Winkleman, and, you know, what it was like sitting next to the plum-faced Mark Lawson when he was quite, you know, rude to me when we were reviewing Adam Sandler's Big Daddy. But surrounded by Andy Warhol-style images of Mark Lawson, Sue Pollard, and all of these people, right? And I thought people would know that I didn't really believe I'd invented The Office, because I once walked past a Staples with Ricky Gervais and went, look at that bloke in there choosing photocopying paper. He looks sad. And then 7 years later, Ricky Gervais wrote The Office. You can't help but see a pattern, right? So I thought these would be clues that this... And so when it got to the end, because I spent a lot of the show, I talked about when Vernon Kay was very rude to me once. I was the last time I ever did TV warm-up, Vernon Kay he had a little go at me. I hadn't been funny enough about where people were from, and Vernon Kay said something. Even the audience kind of thought, it's a bit mean-spirited. So in the show, I talked about how Vernon Kay almost destroyed my life, and then the best way if Vernon Kay nearly destroys your life is to draw a little image of Vernon Kay on a melon and then just leave it on a windowsill in the sun. And as you slowly watch it rot over a period of weeks, it brings joy to your life, right? And then right at the end of the show, I'd get all angry about the fact that things hadn't worked out for me because I'd been too busy writing links for Ben Shepherd on some kind of Channel 5 sports-based show, and I'd never got round to writing my great Ingmar Bergman screenplay or whatever. And I'd start to get really weepy, and then I'd grab the melon that represented Vernon Kay's head, and I would punch it and punch it. And I never got a ripe melon. I deliberately got... My wedding ring has still got the crack in it from over-punching the melon. And I would punch... Sometimes it would take a minute, and then the melon would explode... And I would then just stare at the audience and then start singing Mustang Sally. And then it would go into blackout. And a lot of the audience left going, I think he's had a breakdown. Now... And I thought it was a pretty good show, you know. Yeah. And people who saw it, they either really loved it, or which was a very small number of people, or left just thinking, I don't know whether to feel sad for that bloke or just what a stupid. That's worse than when we saw Donna Stell in Western Supermare, you know. But it was it. Partly in the show, I also I'd been recommended Sid Little's book Little Goes a Long Way. And I would talk about how Sid Little, a lot of his anecdotes kind of help you understand what it's like to be in show business. And there was this great anecdote, which was... And I would have kind of Philip Glass music or Elgar in the background as well. And I read this. There was a lovely one about... I'll see if I can remember my memory. It was... I'll always remember the time I met Cliff Richard. We went to... I remember going around to Cliff Richard's house. He had curry, which was great. I really like curry. As does Cliff, I think, which is nice because it's Cliff's party. He probably does like curry. That's why he's ordered it, right? He goes, I always remember when I met Cliff at an Indian restaurant called the Taj Mahal in Ealing. It was just after Cliff had a hit with the song Little in Love. He walked in. Hello, I said. Hello, he replied. Thanks for writing the song about me. What, he said? A little in love. He did laugh. So it was this great kind of... And it was, and in fact, that sentence on its own, he did laugh. And I used to have this big bit where I would go, so anyone out there who thinks maybe Cliff didn't laugh, let's be fucking clear about this. It's a three-word, he did laugh. There's no debate there. And annoyingly, when the book was co-written and rewritten as Little by Little, which is not nearly as good, if you see in a bookshop Little by Little, it's had a lot of the interesting idiosyncrasies removed. So what you want is Little Goes a Long Way, which is either 50 pence on Amazon or £97.
But I remember you. You were in Edinburgh when we first did This Morning Rich, Not Judy, because you came and did a few of those.
Yeah.
You were up in 1990, I think, the first time you came. That must have been
92, no, it would have 93. Been... I think the first year that I ever did a gig there was 1990, where I did a gig with a fantastic group called Mr. Trellis.
Right.
It was Ardlo Hanlon and Barry Murphy. And, oh, my God, how embarrassing. And the other one, can we dub that in?
Yeah.
And I did a gig there, and then that was the only gig I did. And then at that point, I was working in a place called Greyfriars Kirkhouse, just like kind of doing technical stuff. It's one of those. It's now an art gallery, but it used to be a hostel for homeless people. Apart from in August, so they turn up and they go, "What?" And they go, "Well, not in August." And so it's like really quite cruel.
Yeah.
And obviously a lot of the tramps would then write a show for the next year and see if they get to Greyfriars Kirkhouse. But it had an amazing... Owen O'Neill was on that year, Earl Oakin, Eddie Izzard, a fantastic act called Johnny Material.
Yes.
Who now... Johnny Mears, who's now a children's... And Johnny Material was absolutely fantastic. And so I was working there. And I don't know why I've told you this. Anyway, I still did a gig and it was ages ago. Sorry.
Well, that's
I think there was going to be a point to that.
No, that's the first time we went up. But then I think we did This Morning Not Judy in...
I reckon it'd be 93 or 94.
Yeah. Would have been about that. So you came on and did... I didn't know who you were. You came in. I think you'd met Stu, maybe, had you?
Yeah. I'd met Stu, and we started talking about unpopular independent movies from New York, and we immediately bonded. But it took him 25 years to persuade me to like free jazz. No, you should really like it. It's just like... There's no... It's just... No. Ooh. Wah. Yeah. No one else likes it, but I do, yeah.
So you've been going... Don't know who it was. That's it, Little. I don't know who that was. Don't know. But yeah, I think you've been going a lot longer than I think people might realise, though. I mean, obviously, in the last few years...
Not according to my agent. I'm 24 years old and began in 2007. I started in 1992. I did So You Think You're Funny in Edinburgh, and I got second place to Rona Campbell, as she was then right. Changed her name to Rona Cameron. And that was amazing because it was like, I really wanted to be a stand-up. I'd always been excited by stand-up since I'd seen like Rick Mayall and Alexi Sayle and all those kind of people. And, well, in fact, in particular, Rick Mayall and Alexi Sayle, I think, yeah, that it was that last year when I'm sure you've talked about this on the podcast, but when Rick Mayall died, you know, when you have that moment where you've almost forgotten how vital someone was culturally to you. And Rick Mayall, when I first saw him do it, I mean, it would have been Kevin Turvey probably first of all, and then him turning up on the Russell Harty show, still being Kevin Turvey, right? And it seemed like the most exciting. Alexi Sayle on OTT, the fact that 1 week on OTT, this kind of really terrible late night, partly sketch show thing done by Chris Tarrant, 1 week they'd have Bernard Manning, and the next week they'd have Alexi Sayle, and it was just, I just had to go more the Alexi Sayle route with the angry Marxism as opposed to the casual racism followed by Dean Martin cover. That from that point onwards, the moment that I saw Rick Mayall and Ade Edmondson, and I was with Michael Legg when we found out Rick Mayall had died, and it was one of those things where it felt like if there was a day where Michael Legg, who I've been mates with for as long as I've been a stand-up, two 46-year-old men waking up, sleeping on someone's floor, deciding to have a cushion fight that becomes overly violent. He then smashes my glasses that pinged in half and has to lead me down to Specsavers in the middle of Leeds, right, to find some kind of monocle. And then when we found out Rick Mayall died, it was almost like, oh, well, he's the reason that we're also two 46-year-old men who, even when we're on stage, quite often we pretend to be Daphne and Celeste and really scare people. Where when we were doing our Edinburgh show, Pointless Anger, Righteous Ire, and just two, you know, middle-aged men who haven't even aged well either, late middle-aged men, both of them with different skin complaints, suddenly leap on stage in this room that was entirely red and already the damp on the walls just there. And we just go, oh, stick you, your mama too, and your dad. And you see people going, I'm not sure this is for me, but I'm too scared to leave. And just kind of... All of those things, I know I do, because I fucking watch Rick Mayall, you know, that and that total commitment, all of those things. So that was... But then I started stand-up in, 92, after So You Think You're Funny. And then I managed to survive by living off, you know, predominantly kind of carrots and Bulgarian wine for about 5 years.
Yeah.
And then I was going throughout the 90s, comparing gigs and stuff. But I mean, all the stuff is really awful.
And you were writing, for TV and stuff.
No, I didn't get into that later. I started on the 11 o'clock show, which was a fantastic way of learning about writing, because you would. So, before I did writing on it, because Dave Gorman was script editing, I think, the second series of the 11 o'clock show. And before I started as a drunken bet, which didn't become a book. and I was doing this thing where I would pretend to be John Peel, talking about meeting famous dictators, and including Osama bin Laden, long before he was, you know, I was very prescient in that. I was going, you know, I remember the first time I was DJing at Osama bin Laden's house, and I'd actually lost my stylus, but fortunately someone had just had a hand that was made out of an old coat hanger, so we managed to thin it down, and it rather actually destroyed my copy of The Undertones, but I've got more than one copy of that, obviously. And So I'd just do these long rambles, which originally were filmed with me just doing long rambles, but they thought it would be a better idea for me to do it live in the studio with Daisy Donovan always interrupting at the punchline. And so that was kind of... and then they said, do you want to write on the show? And it's learning how to write on that show and learning that, you know, when you look and sometimes go, oh, those writers are rubbish, and they might be rubbish, but it's probably not what, you know, every single midday you'd go into the producer's office, one of the writers would go, right, it's your turn to go in and do the topical gags. And you would go through the gags, and then the gags that got the biggest laughs, there'd always be one person in the room who afterwards would go, yes, but I don't really think that's right for our demographic or for the people who watch 11 o'clock show. What, the funny one that we all found enjoyable? Yes. We won't be. And so then you would, each night, you would say to the writers, all the other writers, don't watch the show. For fuck's sake, don't watch the show, because you would just hit this kind of level of melancholy, this level of nausea. if you were, and then one act would, you know, one writer would, and they'd come in the next day looking all bleak, and we go, well, we told you, we don't watch the show. And it was, but it was a good education. Because it was, you know.
Yeah, but no, I suppose we went through some. We did Weekending, which was sort of a similar, but not as quite high profile. We didn't like the 11 o'clock show because we were on BBC Two. I actually resented the 11 o'clock show because Channel 4 stayed so true to it. They gave it series after series after series, and the BBC then never did the same for us. We had to keep on coming back and begging. But, you know, it got Ali G and Ricky Gervais.
Although well, lots of things, and actually, you know, whatever you thought of Ian Lee on that show, I think Ian Lee can be very... When he did Rise, the breakfast show,
yeah.
He was... Although I remember going on that once, and he was a bit rude to me, and I said, well, it's not like when you were on the 11 o'clock show, and then when they cancelled it, and you used to ride around Crouch End on a pink tricycle, waving at people, saying, remember me, remember me. And afterwards, the producer said, I wish you hadn't said that, because that was quite close to the truth. So it's one of those, but I didn't know! I mean... Only the colour of the tricycle was wrong.
Or a puce kind of colour. But you did you meet Ricky during that period?
No, I knew Ricky when he was the manager of Suede and a Queen tribute act, but decided that really the money was in the Queen tribute act. So He was the entertainments manager at ULU, that was at University of London Union. And the first time I met him, doing a gig for Avalon, actually, it was one of the Comedy Network gigs. And we both talked about what the best lineup and pattern is in an episode of Celebrity Squares. So we would go, obviously, middle square, Willie Rushton. And then we would go through, you know, top left-hand corner, that's your sporting novelty, but not a wit like Henry Cooper. You'd have him, you know, middle left, middle above or middle below. And so that was basically how we became friends, was we would ring each other up, go, I've realised, blankety-blank, the best lineup. So, right? And then we just stayed friends. And then there was a point where I suddenly found out that he had become tremendously famous and wished to torture me when I talked with him, which was a really bizarre thing where you don't notice when someone suddenly becomes, because I had no idea. And then we were in Dunstable once with the first night the night before, he decided that we should go to where the hell was Lincoln the day before our first gig, our warm-up gig at the Lincoln Theatre. And then we got in this van, and it wasn't how he'd imagined it. I think he'd imagined a tour bus, not a kind of van. Yeah. And then he was really angry because it stank of dog shit, right? He was so angry that it stank of dog shit, right? Later on that day, we found out it was actually on his shoe, and he'd brought it into the van, right? And then we just pulled over, right? He said, pull over, this is ridiculous, we need to get a hotel around here. I said, we've only got as far as Dunstable, why don't we go back to London and start again tomorrow? He went, no, that's it, no, we're doing it, right? And so we went and stayed, and he'd just done the Golden Globes for the first time, or just, I think, appeared, one thing. And so we're walking around Dunstable with people just going, hey, do the dance, which was like, for me, a relief, because he used to be able to torture me in the street, but now if he tried to torture me in the street, someone would spot him and go, do the dance, he'd go, run for your lives, you know? And then we ended up like in this hotel with basically, at one point, he said, order some food, we'll get it brought up, right? And he said, I don't want anyone to know I'm here. So he hid behind the door when the food came. And then the bloke brought in the food, which had most of the things that were actually on the menu that said were in the food, not there. Right. And then he went, oh, can I have your autograph? And it's that embarrassing thing when you're hiding behind a door and you go, yeah, of course you can, there we go. So the...
But you did a 2001 Edinburgh show with Stephen Merchant, Jimmy Carr and Ricky Gervais.
Yeah.
And you.
And me.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much how there was a thing in, I think it was Word magazine, Mark Allen and Dave Hepworth magazine. They once did a long interview with Jimmy Carr. And it had one of the publicity stills with all four of us. And it just, Steve Merchant, Ricky Gervais, Jimmy Carr. I really like, because that's almost part of really where the award-winning Robin Ince came from, because I've never had a big enough ego. I've found it much funnier to be, and some bloke who's probably just come up to mend the balcony they're on and happens to be snapped while he's next to these showbiz greats.
At least they didn't cut you off, though. They could have cut you off.
You off is probably better, isn't it? To actually know he's there, but I can't see him. It's surely worse than... Just snip him off.
Or if it just says unknown. That's the worst. Like, sometimes you get those old photos of, like, revolutionaries. I'll mention three of them. Don't know who that is.
If any of you know who this person is, please email the Word subscription.
There was a lot of, you know, if you'd known at the time... how much money the people in that show were going to be worth in within 15 years' time.
Ricky and Steve had already done The Office,
yeah.
And it, the first series was going out at that time. And Steve Merchant is one of the best stand-up comedians I've ever seen. I think if you've never seen it, and he does another, I don't think maybe I'll never do another tour, but it's just every single night I would just watch his set, and it would stay almost exactly the same, but there would always be another nuance or another, and it was this beautiful thing about this bloke coming on with a lot of high status, saying he's the best comedian in the world, and by the end of it going, don't tell anyone you've seen me, I'll say you were lying, don't come up to me at the bar and say, well done, it could have been worse, just leave me alone, right? He would do this whole, and he's just 6'7", the whole look of him there, and then he'd storm off stage, and then there'd be no one on stage for about 20 seconds, then he'd walk back out and he goes, you can't get out that way, and it's just everything about it was, and I think in terms of tears of laughter, he's kind of up there with watching Laurel and Hardy's County Hospital, right? It's just he, and what used to be really joyous about watching Steve Merchant on the comedy circuit as well was some comics didn't get him, they just didn't understand what was going on. And so once you were unable to breathe and truly asthmatic from the experience of watching him, you'd then turn and see a comic going, huh? And then you'd fall through a door. I mean, I did. I once fell through a door watching Steve Merchant. He was just fantastic to watch. And, you know, Jimmy was very much Jimmy.
So I'll talk about this. I'm getting tired, and I want this to go on for a long time. So I'll talk about this while I'm still. If I fall asleep, just carry on talking. Don't take it personally.
If you fall asleep, I'm going to carry you away like cannon and ball. You know that bit where Bobby's asleep, the wind beneath my wings.
You have said you are giving up doing stand-up comedy.
Yeah,
and this is your last stand-up comedy tour.
Well, not exactly.
For a bit.
Yeah.
But do you think that's a good idea? I mean, like, isn't the thing that you just do, like, you when you tour about 5 shows. So you're inevitably going to go, oh, stand-up, I don't like stand-up, I'm doing...
It's not that I don't like stand-up, though. I love stand-up. Yeah. I think stand-up is... It can drive you insane. I mean, I think the person who's most worried is my wife, because, you know, my touring kind of schedule is very good for... If you live with a really annoying man, there's nothing better than him often being in Stoke-on-Trent or Belfast. And so I was out... I think I was in Australia, and she rang me up. She went, what's this about you giving up stand-up? I went, oh, well, it's just... I said, well, why didn't you tell me? I said, it'll be all right. I've got other ways that we can make some money. It's not... She went, no, but I mean, why... And this was the one she found out because she saw a piece in The Independent, which is not how it should have happened, right? But I'd written this blog post, and The Independent had gone, well, if we add some other sentences, that can be some journalism. And so... And eventually I went, look, everything's going to be fine. I realised what this is about. This is not about a fear of, you know, how you and our child will survive. It is you going, you're going to be in the house the whole fucking time. And between 7 and 10, you'll have all the adrenaline you normally have. Look at me doing voices. Imagine if Stuart Lee was James Bond, you know.
But you do like a ridiculous amount. I mean, I remember doing a gig with you in Shepherd's Bush, where you were in the middle act in Shepherd's Bush, I was comparing, and you'd come from you'd done the open slot in Cambridge. You don't even drive. You can't even drive. You'd got a train to... I mean, and then you were going off after the Shepherd's Bush to do a gig across London.
Yeah.
That's insanity. Who would double up between Cambridge and Shepherd's Bush? It's like a long way.
But it is... It's a bit like... Let's start with Edinburgh, right? The reason that I would sometimes do... And you do this in Edinburgh. Sometimes I would do 4 shows a day, 4 different shows, and then friends for shows for mates as well. And the thing is that what else are you going to do? Because when you're younger, you think it's stand up. You kid yourself and you go, well, I don't need to do anything today because I've got work tonight. And then you would go and stand in a Firkin pub for 20 minutes with your wry take on Baywatch or whatever you were doing in the early 90s. And then you'd go, well, that's a full day's work. And then you get a bit older and you do, I think Mark Watson mentioned it on your podcast.
Love Mark Watson. Yeah. Obsessed with that podcast.
But you do, you know, you think, well, life is finite. I think existence is finite. And it's much better to just try and do loads of, I mean, I do think that's why I'm giving up stand-up for a bit, is actually, in the end, you do go, that was a bit much, wasn't it? And you do find yourself... Yeah, it's. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. I've been doing stand-up since I was 22 years old. So, and it is like an act of trepanning. It is, you know, the day after the election, and I'm, you know, all cross, and kind of, and I'm playing Horsham that night, where 58% of the population there voted Conservative, leaving 8,000 to vote UKIP. And you have this, and which was not in my audience, obviously. My audience is like 130 people going, don't tell them we're here. And the... And you have, and you can go out on stage, and this rage, you know, all that, like all the shows that I do with Michael, which are entirely, or hopefully on most nights, just made up on the actual night, just dicking around, and to lose that kind of, you know, the drill into the skull to go let these things out.
But it seems to come a little bit from disillusionment about touring. You know, you'll say, as I think we're in a similar position with touring, you and I think, in and it's quite a rare position, because most people can't tour, most comedians can't tour because they're not well known enough at all to sell any tickets on their own name, and then most comedians who do tour are so well known that they'll get thousands of people, or hundreds of people coming to see them, and you and I are in this kind of middle bit where we might get 50, we might get 500. And there are places we go where it's 50 people.
Yeah.
And you've travelled, usually when the one you've travelled the furthest to.
Yeah.
So you've driven...
Or it was Annick that did it for me.
Yeah.
It was Annick where... It's a lovely venue, and I knew I'd been back too soon, because I reckon once every, like, 13, 14 years is probably... that's enough. And then on the side of the theatre, in the actual auditorium, are these big paintings of Tommy Cooper and Eric Morecambe and other people who had tremendously successful careers and would never have ended up, one, in Annick, and two, in Annick playing to 50 people, right? Yeah. And it's a really lovely venue, and I'm not, you know, in that way. They like, backstage, they go, we've just left you a whole cake. And that's the... then the next day, there's roadworks, and your friend is dropping you off to get that pre-booked train to Newcastle... don't get there in time, and then the man goes, you have to pay £121 for a ticket, and you think, I played to 48 people in Annick, and this is, and you think, I'm going to die running back of this ridiculous man running across trying to get to his train with his deodorant flying out the back of his rucksack and various different notes which, if read, appear to be kind of, you know, the songs that Jeffrey Dahmer would have written or whatever, and it's just, and so all of those things, and I thought, I'm just going to give it, because no one thinks in any town, one, no one goes, he may never be back again. You know, I played Leeds 6 times last year, Manchester about 8 times. And then, you know, and if you are in a smaller town that really only wants to see someone like me once every 3 years. That's more than enough. So I thought, if I take 3 years off, you know, I might, there's a possibility I'll go, fucking hell, why don't I ever do stand-up? Well, it was a waste. I'm really enjoying myself here. You know, this is a nice Waterstones to work in. They've given me a nice section, you know. Every now and again, someone goes, oh, you sound a bit like that bloke who used to be on the radio with the Pretty Scientist. You know, all of those things.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
So, but I have to, nearly every stand-up said to me that they give me about 1 month of not doing stand-up.
Yeah, I think you might find it different. I mean, I just, it feels to me you do so many different shows that maybe if you, you know, just, it may be not the op, it might not be stop and go. It might just be, let's turn the volume down a bit. It's not like people, I think people tend to do this with it. People do something too much and they become unhappy with it and they think, oh, because Happiness is the opposite of unhappiness. Me doing the opposite of what I'm doing will make me happy. And actually, that's like saying, oh, this TV volume's a bit loud. I'll mute it completely. That will make me happy. You know, it's actually just a matter of turning the knob a little bit and working out what you can do. Because if you're doing all those little towns...
What an old television you've got. I'm just sitting there, not even near the telly. Yeah. Living my incredible dream from all the repeat fees from the 11 o'clock show.
But there are enough tiny... There are enough of those. I mean, I go to Cumbria... once a tour, probably. And I play a different town in Cumbria every time I go to a general ambivalence. But there are enough towns in Cumbria, you can go there and you'll be in that town once every 6 years. There are enough towns, and no one will ever come and see me, but there are enough towns in the country that you can go back every now and again. I think it can be dispiriting because you can look at other people and go, oh, why are they getting 500 people and I'm getting 50 people? But then I think you always, and then you'll get that on Twitter, you'll go, oh, there's still tickets available. Yes, I bet there are still tickets available. And you kind of go, you know, I wonder if you could sell 50 tickets in any town and how long those 50 people... You know, the idea that 50 people have paid £10-15 to come and see you is sort of quite... when you look at it the other way, it's sort of incredible.
Oh, no,
and to those 50 people... because they, you know, they won't get, they'll get the big names coming to somewhere near them, but they won't get an esoteric weird comedian coming. And for those 50 people, it's almost more important, isn't it? Than
well, no, I think that's why if I take a bit of a break, I think I'll be. I mean, I was, you know, some of the places that I've played in the last few months, where like one venue in Cumbria actually, which I played quite a few times, probably too many times, the lowest audience I had. But the loveliest audience, they were all, you know, I know some of them by name. Some of them say things to me like, would you like to come and stay in our cottage when we were away? It's on the side of a lake. Someone had brought me a cake, not just a little cake, a great big bloody cake, right? Yeah. On the box outside, it said, just a menace. And then I opened it, and it was a picture of Sheila Hancock on the cake, done boss-eyed, because they felt she was overly cruel to me when I was on Just a Minute. Now that... you... And I do think this is in no way that, you know, in a lot of the places that I play, the people that I love talking most, it's like some of the stadium comics that I know and arena comics, they look at, they're all just fucking hell, God. And they're all bitter about going, fucking hell, do you know what? I think I'm only making $250,000 for doing my hour tonight, right? And they don't like their audience. Whereas the 50 people who do turn up in whichever Cumbrian town we're playing that particular year, they're really nice people and they want to talk about stuff and, and they'll bring you things. Oh, I found this book that I thought you'd like. I mean, the cake thing I really like because this person obviously also doesn't know that I use the train. So I then spent the next 2 days with a rucksack on and a satchel carrying a cake carefully, you know, cause which I quite like. Or maybe she did know. Sheila Hancock wrote to me and said, make him a cake. It's just the kind of idiot that will think I better carry it all the way home. But that's so I think all of those things, it's a lot of the time I think it's very easy to accept that, like, so, like I was watching the brilliant band Giant Sand, just the footage of them at Glastonbury, and they're a great band and they've been going like 30 years whatever, and incredible albums, and watching them at the Park stage with look like about 40 people. You think, but nevertheless, the 40 people, and I've always found whenever I've gone to see Giant Sand live, that you can kind of talk to anyone who's there because, well, we've all got a lot in common. We have a lot in common because we like Giant Sand. Yeah. It's not like if you were at, you know, a U2 gig or something. Oh, we've got a lot in common with all of the, you know, we like Giant Sand and therefore... And that's also, I think that's almost what a lot of stand-ups are. It's like, because even though there are lots of nerdy stand-ups who are into horror movies or whatever and into weird bands and stuff, when we were at school, we might have been the only one who wrote to Boris Karloff's widow to get a signed photo, and which I've lost. I don't know where it is. If anyone knows, I'm quite annoyed about that. You know, an 11-year-old boy finding out that there's not that many Karloffs in the London phone directory at that point and making a guess. All of that. And so you then have to go, well, we've always been a little bit on the margins anyway. So what on earth is ever going to make us the kind of people that 20,000 people go, I imagine that'll be entertaining in this particular aerodrome.
So that's a good thing then. So that you're doing something that's, you know, you've self-created something. You're doing it in your own, by your own... doing it on your own.
Wind beneath my wings.
You're doing it on your own terms, you know, and it's and that there's something amazing about that. And then if you're getting that personal reaction, what about those people who make, they're making cakes and they're leaving them sadly?
Exactly,
out, sadly
it's brilliant.
Out? for the birds because Robin Ince isn't coming to eat his cake this year.
We did the whole cake like a melon with Bernard Kay's face on it. And we used his real skin. No, I love all that stuff, but that's why I think if I take a couple of years off and I'm thinking of writing a couple of books that aren't going to get published.
Yeah.
And making a film that's not going to be big in Turkey. It's going to be quite popular in Cyprus, a little bit more niche. But I think it's... I don't want to lose the excitement I have about it. I mean, someone who I saw... Did anyone here see Jim Dale the other week? Has anyone seen him play the West End? Who saw him? What did you reckon? I thought it was fucking brilliant. It was. Right, Jim Dale, nearly 80 years old, and best known in this country for the Carry On films, but in the US, Broadway star, the first ever Barnum, you know, he's won Emmys and Tonys, and he went on, and you just, you know when you just sit somewhere and you go, this is the greatest night, it's just one bloke and a piano, and him talking about that moment in his life where he was, do you remember the town he was from in Northamptonshire? I've forgotten it, it's the same name as one of the writers from the Carry On, Rothwell, I think it is, Rothwell, right? And he says the first day he goes to work and he's been to the music hall and he's seen it and it's fantastic and he's just up against a brick wall and he's going to be making shoes and there's a big bonfire burning bits of shoes and he turns to the old bloke who's there, he says, oh, what time did they light that? And he said, oh, it's about 38 years ago, I think. And he went, I'm leaving. And he left and went, I'm going to make it in music hall or something. And that for 2 hours he's on stage with two things I saw that week was I watched Jim Dale and I watched a Laurel and Hardy double bill with just a whole audience that just pissing them. So yeah, and with my favourite line for Lauren Hardy, which I used to put into stand-up with audiences going, I've no idea why I said that, hard-boiled eggs and nuts. Why didn't you get me any candy? Well, you haven't paid me for the last lot. But it's just... And it's and you watch. I was sat next to Johnny Vegas, and we were about who'd grown a little Oliver Hardy moustache just for the night, which I thought was absolutely all right. And I'm properly wiping it at the moment that Oliver Hardy's having the greatest time ever in hospital. He's loving it. He's got his leg up. He's reading a book, and then he hears Stan whistling, and he just goes, closes the book, flips it off the bed, and 20 minutes later, of course, the surgeon's going, both of you get out of my hospital! And watching those two things, which are, as, you know, they're filled with fucking love. You know, what Jim Dale had was, and everyone that I knew, like, there was nice work, because Barry Cryer was in the audience, and I think I wrote that joke, and it was actually, Barry was in the audience, and Lionel Blair was as well, and afterwards, when Barry, I was chatting to him outside, and he was going, oh no, Lionel Blair's here, I've been trying to avoid him for 5 years. I love a show his spat. That's all down to I'm sorry I haven't a clue and all that stuff, but that kind of a bloody old Blair's here. It's going to kick off. He's wearing his tap shoes already. But yeah, I just, and when you watch things like that, that's why I don't want to go out. I never want to go out on stage. And again, Rick Mayall is another good example of just utter fucking commitment. You know, I think more and more, the older I've got, every single show, I want to pretty much be hoarse by the end of it. I want to make sure that I, you know, the audience might hate me, but it's not due to a lack of my showing off and being ridiculous.
Yeah. Fair enough. I forgot to say, even though I said I wouldn't forget, I forgot, I should have said this in my opening monologue. Ewan McInnes, do you know Ewan?
Yeah.
He's on a... he was on a Rehef for a Hef. Thank you. I praised Ewan McInnes's lack of commercialism. He's now using this series to again promote his book, Edinburgh for Everyone, and his up-and-coming book, for which he has no title. Clearly, he still lacks commercialism. That was what I was meant to say to him. Paul Craigie has got a question for you. He paid £60 to ask this, so make sure you answer it.
Okay.
If a question has no definitive answer, why bother asking it?
That's a much better question than one with a definitive answer. How dull is a question? 1873. Whereas if the answer is, well, there's a few different ideas currently about this, and then you go on about it. It's a much more, you know, the moment you realise that there is almost no definitive answer in everything, before Brian Cutts goes, well, actually, in physics, fuck off. You've only got one law that's particularly thorough. A lot of the rest of them are up in the air. And but it's... That's why it's more exciting to ask that question, because then you can sit around and everyone has a different answer. And some of them you'll think, they are dicks, and I will no longer hang around with them. And others you will go, yeah, not bad.
Good answer. Are you aware of Dirty Britcom Confessions, the website Dirty Britcom Confessions?
No.
I can't believe you're on. Johnny Vegas has no entries on this, which is kind of... I think he's one of the sexiest guys in comedy. Robin Ince, who I consider one of the least sexy guys in comedy, has a lot of answers. I'll just show this to the people at home. They can see this. Someone has said... This is people...
Oh, my God, that's me topless backstage at the Larne Festival, where at the Larne, there was a hen night in. Josie Long and me were doing a show, and we always get a lot of hens and stags, obviously, because that's very much our demographic, right? And so... At one point, and they were a lovely hen night. At one point, I said, obviously, later on, I will be loosening the cardigan. And then I took the cardigan off. And then right at the end, I thought, well, in a moment of Morrissey-esque ridiculousness, I just ripped off my black shirt and threw it into the hen night. And then Phil Jupiter just looked at me afterwards. He went, you've ruined your brand.
Well, this website has people's sexual fantasies about comedians, British comedians usually. They're anonymous. This first person says, that shirtless picture of Robin Ince is the best thing that has happened to me and my sex life in the last months.
I wonder where he's serving and how long that sentence is.
Interesting that you feel it's definitely a man saying that. But I think it is. So let's have a look. Someone says,
oh, I find this stuff really kind of creepy and weird.
Yeah, that's why we're doing it.
This was such a lovely conversation. I really, you know.
This will be over in 5 to 10 minutes. I'm in brain love with Robin Ince. That's kind of.
That's
nice?
Fine. That returns to kind of the trepanning thing.
Yeah, that's true.
Or that scene in the film Hannibal. Ray Liotta.
Just see how interested you are in this one. I wish Robin Ince wasn't married. I'm pretty sure I'm about half a bottle of wine away from stalking the crap out of him. It's getting a bit much. I recently saw him at the Arts Emergency gig at the Hackney Empire, and I spent the whole time he was on stage just imagining us together, rough, sweaty, perfect.
See, the only time I'm kind of rough and sweaty is when the stepladder's a bit rickety, when I'm carrying a lot of the heavier books up to the high shelf. That's when I... God damn it, why do I buy so many 1930s encyclopedias?
This page is good. This is a good one. I have this fantasy where I walk in on Brian Cox giving Robin Ince mind-blowing head. This is nice. Yeah, the postman not the letterbox, so that's good.
It's just the idea of immediately afterwards as he then goes, oh, the art.
And as they see me, Robin says to Brian, go and put that perfect mouth to good use. And we end up having a threesome all centred around me.
Was that Jim Elkalili?
Would you be up for that?
Do you know what? I'm very much up for basically getting an allotment. Yeah. That's what I just...
Would you be up for this? I would like... This is quite a full-on one. I would like Robin Ince to come all over me and then lick it all off. Seems like a punishment.
It's really weird that it's only right at the end that the true Richard Herring appears in this podcast. There's suddenly this demonic revelation.
We're nowhere near the end. So,
Did you read Stuart, the ones from that?
I don't know if I did. I don't know if there are some that have both of us inevitably. I don't know if I have done it. I've done two with him, but they've both been sort of themed around our DVD, the DVD... Or the lack of a DVD in the end of this morning, Richie Not Judy. But a Fist of Fun. You can buy Fist of Fun. There it is. But gofasterstripe.com, where we can also buy Robin Ince DVDs, if you were so willing to do that. They're good. Are you still vegan? You went vegan for
a while? No, I did vegan for about a month and a half, and then I might give it another go. I thought it was quite, you know, it was an interesting thing to do, but it was. I think the second day I was at Birmingham Airport, which it turns out doesn't have a really good vegan selection. And that point of going from every different, and looking at everything, and then the last thing will always say, and some milk, or a small amount of sheep's blood, or whatever, everything that, why do they need that to make these particular biscuits, just to fuck off vegans, you know, it really felt very spiteful.
Yeah.
And then I eventually found a slightly out of date cup of leaves that Boots do. And obviously, because no one's bought a cup of leaves, apart from obviously every time, just they're out of date, the one vegan that comes to Birmingham Airport goes, the cup of leaves. And as I ate those leaves, I thought, I don't know if I'll get into this for 2-3 years. Yeah. But I'm going to try it again. I think that's a very hard thing with touring, is doing that kind of thing.
Well, and just anywhere, veganism, it's insane.
No, but
I was vegetarian for like 12 years, and it was hard enough. I mean, it's easier now, I think.
Well, vegetarianism is quite an easy thing to do now. But veganism, I think, is... I like the idea of... It's like, it's a bit like giving up stand-up. It's kind of that experiment where you go, well, I don't have any religion, so how can I punish myself? You know, veganism feels like that kind of... I love chocolate. I love milk chocolate. I don't like dark chocolate. Well, maybe get that out of your life. You love doing stand-up. Why not stop doing that and just eat dark chocolate on a bench near your allotment?
But you gave it drinking for a long time. I see you're drinking
I did
now.
Drinking for a year, stopped drinking for a year, and then Michael Legg was the one who made me drink again. And that was kind of one of the reasons I thought I should give up stand-up for a little bit.
Michael Legg makes you feel like that as well. There's some comedians you watch them and go, they're so good, I'm going to give up stand-up. And then there are other comedians you think, they're so bad, I'm going to give up stand-up. It's just a little joke.
But, so when we were doing the Angry Show, about halfway through in this red room dripping with sweat, he just went, oh, for fuck's sake, I can't work with you anymore, with you being sober. This is fucking killing me. So he charged off and he got two tins of Red Stripe and he started his and he left the other one on a stool. And I thought, well, what shall I do? And then I spent quite a lot of time telling the audience about issues that I'd had with drinking and, you know, problems and stuff and creating this level of melodrama and going that I felt a little bit bad. But, and they, I think they kind of believed me as well, you know. And I said, no, but we have fun with the show anyway. And then, you know, and that Michael knows that there's been some problems. And then about 15 minutes later, I just grabbed the can and ripped it open and just drank the whole thing. And I thought, I've turned down really lovely... Like, when you do go drinking with Brian Cox goes, you must try this wine. And it's like... It's fucking the great, you know, it's made in the Large Hadron Collider, individual grapes being sent round and colliding with each other to make all of these things. And and I turned all that down, but thinking what will be the best moment in front of an audience, well, I better start drinking again then. And so that was it. And then he kept deliberately buying me different drinks every single night. And then I...
Now you're an alcoholic.
No, but there are... There's human mints in my drain again, just after it was clear.
Kentucky Fried Chicken, that's what you're going to say that is. That's a little serial killer reference there for you. Fans of serial killing. That's what the one who worked at the DHSS...
What, Dennis Nielsen?
Dennis Nielsen, yeah. When they found body parts... No, he said, well, he knew they were going to come and check the drain, so he started flushing Kentucky Fried Chicken down so that he could claim it was all Kentucky Fried Chicken that he'd been flushing down.
That would have been fantastic, though, if that's... For a while, surely one of the newspapers would have believed that was the Colonel's secret recipe. And they would...
I've offended a man over there. Yeah. He's managed to sit through the rest of the whole podcast. So I'd say that
he's ruined the civilized delight of eating from a bucket.
Ruined murder. The murder.
My bride's head revisited nights as I sit there like Sebastian Fly eating from a fucking bucket.
Dennis Nielsen was quite... Out of all the serial killers, he was the funniest serial killer. He was interrogated in a cell when he was smoking, and he said, what should I do with the cigarette end? And the policeman said, just throw it down the toilet. He said, I got into trouble last time I did that. And one of his victims had a tattoo across his neck saying, cut here, and so he did. So, there, you know, that's...
It's weird, isn't it? They don't concentrate on his wit.
So, well, you do all these science. You've done the incomplete map of the cosmic genome.
Yeah.
What the hell is that about? I'm in that.
That was, you are in that.
Yeah. What the hell is it?
It's basically just, it's a bunch of scientists and people who are interested in science or people who are backstage at one of my gigs. We film them and ask them questions about if they're scientists, why they do the work they do, what particularly drew them to science, stuff like that. So it's lots of, it's basically, it's an app. And it's just, we've managed to fill the whole kind of periodic table now with different people. And we're now going to do a kind of rotating double helix of different people as well. But it's just the idea of basically, I'd started to make some money and I thought, well, this app, I could put money into that and that will lose a lot of cash. And it did. So it's kept me as an artist, you see. Every single time that there's a level of comfort. Eddie Izzard once gave me the advice. He once came around to my flat many, many years ago and he saw that I had an airing cupboard and he said, you shouldn't have an airing cupboard. That's too much as a comedian. That's too much comfort. Which I just loved the idea that what drove Lenny Bruce? Damp towels. You know, it's the. So, yeah.
But, do you feel like, obviously, you've done the Infinite Monkey Cage, and then a lot of these things. Well, Brian goes on to do things on TV with
Dara Green, yeah.
Do you feel that that's, do you feel slighted by that genuinely? I mean, I know you make jokes about it, but
not really. I don't, I mean, Dara Brin does actually know physics. I think on television they want another person who knows something, whereas on radio they want a kind of idiot to put the brakes on every single time it becomes too convoluted or confusing, and I play that role very well in the same way as Dara plays being learned very
but
well.
But you're very, you know, you know a lot about this stuff as well.
Yeah, at a very surface level. I mean, I don't really, I don't have, you know, I'm fascinated by all these ideas, and I love, you know, to get the chance to sit around with some incredible, you know, some of the people that you see, oh yeah, whether it is Brian Blessed or whether it is Sir Paul Nurse, who's, you know, this great kind of, you know, he's fantastic. Sir Paul Nurse, I think I told that story where I had a lovely evening where you, when you're actually hanging around with a Nobel Prize winner, you think, I really normally feel like a fucking idiot, but now I'm in a new level of stupidity. And then you see that Nobel Prize winner unable to work out how a taxi door opens. And you kind of go, there was a purpose that I evolved as well. And that was to go, it's like that, Sir Paul. Thank you. And that's it. You know, I've, that chance, and it's a very, I find it really genuinely very, again, I think it comes back to all the things that I find most exciting, which are people who are really passionate. And I think the people on our show who guest on the show who are best are people who they really want to talk about why they've gone into whatever, you know, whether it's epigenetics or whether it's particle physics, quantum cosmology, whatever it might be. And it's, and what I love as well is sometimes when you've done some of the science shows at Christmas, you've done a lot of the science shows at Christmas, and some of the scientists will sometimes go, well, I don't really know what I should do because I'm not very funny. And you go, well, you're not really meant to be funny because there's lots of people like Richard Herring who will be doing the funny thing. They'll be doing their Ferrero Rocher routine, and which is a very good routine. And then you, Richard Dawkins, will go on and talk about spiders' webs. Can I do some cock gags? You can do a couple of cock gags as long as they've been peer-reviewed via Richard Herring's Talking Cock book. I've read it cover to cover. The
Do you think it's possible to be too clever and know too much stuff?
I think it's possible to believe that you're too clever. I think that's, you know, a different... I don't know if this... I think the moment that you start to be excited about knowledge and knowing things, there is a point where that is going to increase, you know, existential angst and, you know, fear of you know, finite nature and all that kind of thing. But I don't think it's a particularly agonising... I once did a thing with... Will Self was on, I think it was Loose Ends on Radio 4, and he'd just done a documentary with Carl Pilkington. Carl Pilkington interviewing people who are really clever and saying that it's probably ruined their lives, it's better to be a bit stupid. And Will Self, he just sat there and went, I mean, he's just an idiot. And he looked genuinely frustrated and possibly angry. That even I think he probably knew it was kind of a reasonably comedic documentary, but still, I mean, he's so... It was a really... You know, Will Selford is angriest, cutting away at his cock and balls to write another short story. The and... But I don't think it is possible, but I think it's possible to be very arrogant and believe that you... I mean, that moment where you just go, oh, bloody hell, there's so much to know. And you just, that's one of the reasons I'm stopping stand-up again, is I just want to... Because, as you know, you get asked to do... When something happens in the news, oh, hello, Richard Herring, we're from a radio station and we'd like you to talk about this. And you sometimes think, well, it's good publicity for my show in Cumbria, but at the same time, I don't really have any interest in this. And suddenly... you know, it's like Question Time. You see comics on Question Time, and some of them can be very, very good on it, but comics have that ability to have an appearance of knowledge and a confidence as they deliver what inside they're going, I have no fucking idea if this is true. I have no idea if this is about strange quarks, charm quarks. I don't even know what a fucking quark is. But as long as I keep talking and looking like this, people go, he's very wise on quarks. You know, so that I think that's one of the, you know, the dangers of not realising you're a fucking idiot.
Well, maybe. It's probably most... I mean, a lot of people that you get on TV are just good at talk, you know, experts on anything are just good at talking about
the
way the thing
I would say about Brian Cox is he really does love those things. He's not faking it. You know, there was like photosynthesis, bloody hell did he bang on about that for ages. It was like he didn't like biology, but once he found out there was quantum behaviour in photosynthesis, every time we were in a minibus, there we go. And the thing is, you say, oh, I know. But that's great. It's like he doesn't just go, I know loads about physics and look at this great hair, which some people are now saying they believe he's deliberately dying grey, bits of it grey, as if to give him this hint of alluring mortality.
Is there a God? And if not, where did all this stuff come from?
Which God do you want?
I don't know. I don't mind. I just want to know which one it is. Well, I'd like to know which one
I reckon
it is.
It's Odin. I reckon if you have to... I'm quite keen on Odin as a god. So I think if I'm going to... If there's any god, it's Odin. And he's not happy with you, Richard Herring.
No, it makes sense. That's what going back over my many shows, the Hercules Terrace one's about the way that the Greek and Roman gods at least make sense of the universe. Because it doesn't make sense that one god, a perfect god's made an imperfect world. I don't know if that's even possible, if something perfect can create something imperfect. But with the Roman gods, it might make sense, doesn't it? There's all these competing gods and stuff goes wrong because they're all trying to fuck each other up and they're childish and they're like dicking around with people. That kind of makes sense of the world.
Well, that's what I think is a really intriguing thing about. I do find it harder and harder now when I have had to go to churches, or the other day I had to go to like a religious school, and there is just that little moment where I see the crucifixes up there and there is something inside me which goes, I don't mind, you know, I don't have a problem if people have got a kind of nice little liberal belief in deities or whatever. There's a bit where the older I get, the more I go, this is really fucking wonky. This is really bizarre to me that this is still there. And I love Quakers and I love you. Well, I love the Unitarians most, because I've done a few Unitarian gigs, and the fact you don't even have to believe in God to be a Unitarian, the fact it's that loose, which is just, we'll just meet up, you know, and then just be nice. Okay, be nice. That's it. And I did one of their gigs where I was the warm up to their service, right? So an hour long warm up before then, and they have hymns, which are basically hymns about, and then humans built a machine in 1742. And it's all these things about how to, you know, the plowing and ingenuity, looking through a telescope, seeing the stars, it's a big, big universe. And so, and their reading was from Dennis Potter's Seeing the Blossom. You know, today's reading comes from, I'll do the part of Melvin Bragg. When I did it, they borrowed someone's Baptist church, and just before I started, they went, we will take the cross down before you go on, because you never know, it might get into the papers in Hove. So, so Odin is... Odin. But I do find it, I don't have a problem with it, but the older I got, the more I find it.
But the problem I have with the Big Bang, and I talked at some length in one of my other shows about this with an expert on the subject, but I don't understand what was there before and where that came. Where did the super concentrated matter come from?
But that's the bit that becomes really difficult, is the fact that there are things that we are not really... I've imagined. It's very, very hard to imagine there was to even say there was a time when there was no time.
Yeah.
So there is no universe. There is no time. There
what
is no
time
place.
Was it
there is
when,
no,
there was, when there wasn't any time, what was the time?
It was just before time. Just before then,
so,
right?
1 second to there being time, 2 seconds before there would still have been some time.
Exactly. No, there's no time. There's no time. Marcus Chown said he got very angry with you. But that is, and I think that's kind of delightful and very, I mean, my son now, who's 7 years old, he's begun to think about these ideas of Big Bang and how it might have worked and whatever, and, you know, you have these questions. And I still find the idea of the billions of years that you have laid out behind you, and then the possibility of, well, the fact that, you know, this solar system only has a certain amount of time. That moment where you go, oh my God, there's only 4.5 billion years left. And you kind of almost go, oh, bloody hell, that's not far off, is it? And then you go, oh yeah, except all life on Earth and all the whole kind of existence of the planet Earth and the sun, that happened over 4.5. This is probably still quite a lot of time, but that idea. Those moments where, like evolution, like the idea of self-consciousness, I find self-consciousness such... most animals just get by with having no idea they even exist.
Yeah.
They eat and they fuck and they try and survive, and then somewhere along the line, we start to recognise ourselves in a mirror, and then the advertising industry. So it's, you know, it's kind of, it can be, it's a problematic thing.
It is. I just want the answers. That's all I want, Robin. That's, you know, just the same as the religious people, because they just go, just say, oh, it happened. And then a magic thing happened. That was it. It's just the same.
It is the same, actually. That was a very convincing argument.
Thank you. I will... I'll ask you one more question, then we'll go. Because, you know, people will have missed the emergency questions, and I think you'll be good at this emergency question. I'm just slightly adapting. If you had a finger that could travel through time, but just your finger, what would you do with it? Where would you go, and what would your finger do in time? Past, future, present, probably not worth doing present, but it would be able to travel in time and space, so you could do something in the present.
I would send it to Galileo's recently removed finger, which is still in a museum, and the fingers would meet. And then in years to come, people would believe I'd presciently imagined the future of the South Bank show. Okay. So that would be...
You could create, and then you could walk past that and then put that in your show.
Yeah.
Saying, and I created the title to the South Bank show.
And then I'd end by punching a melon that represented Melvin Bragg's face before breaking into Dancing in the Street by Martha Reeve and the Vandellas and get some very poor reviews again.
Well, I hope you will come back to doing stand-up. But if not if you don't want to.
No, but I really like, there's no negativity about stand-up. It was just that point of, I think I overdid it.
Yeah.
I've been showing off for a long time, and it was time to have a little bit of a sit down.
You do a lot. You do too much. And it is really hard. And I think as you get older, it's really hard. It's just the travel and everything is wearing. Though I sort of enjoy the shows much more now when I'm...
I love that. I don't think I've ever enjoyed stand-up more than I do now, which is typical, because that's the way it always works, doesn't it? Oh, I really miss that. You know, again, it returns to that idea, which is everyone is looking forward to something and everyone is remembering something fondly. It's only when you're there that it seems shit. You know, that's the... And I actually, though, at the moment in touring, and I think I'm getting better as a stand-up. You know, I don't think... I'm certainly not as bad as I was in 1997. I mean, I have some bad nights. That's the thing as well, that ability where you go, as long as, when you're having good shows and everything's pretty, you think, oh, I love stand-up. And then you have one that's a bit, even a little bit bad, just something went a bit wonky. The audience didn't even hate you or anything like that. It just wasn't good. And you go, I'm fucking useless, pathetic, isn't it? What pathetic. Yeah. Just sitting there, everyone sat there going, stupid old man, whereas now they're going, stupid old men. You know, and that was one of the reasons that I decided to give up, was basically just the kind of the Waldorf and the Statler in my head were getting so loud. And I thought, like, when I was out in Australia, I had nights... I was out in LA. We did an American tour of the Infinite Monkey Cage. And there was a night where, round at Eric Idle's house, right? Eric Idle, who... Fucking Eric Idle. And just having dinner with Jeff Lynne and Steve Martin. And I just sat there going, the fuck am I doing here? This is ridiculous. This is... I should be back in Berkhamsted at the moment. I wonder what's in Oxfam. I don't know if this is right for me at all. I'm really worried. I feel under a lot of pressure because there's fucking Steve Martin there, isn't there? This is... am I eating this in the right way? Is Eric Idle judging me? It's, you know, all of these things. What's really on the inside of Jeff Lynne's dark glasses? All of these... And to have that moment of going, I'm not sure I should be... Not sure I should be there because they're all great. Oh, they are. I mean, that's... But the other side of it going, I should probably be at home, actually. I just shouldn't be doing this. Silly. And yet I'm meeting people who... were my heroes.
Yeah, but I think if you don't feel like that, that's when it's a problem. I think, you know, I think the people who don't, who get into those situations, think, "Yep, I should be here."
But it's not. It's a separate not being here. It's not
it is,
one. Obviously, I'm there going, I shouldn't be here because these people are. But it's the other bit of going, I probably shouldn't really be touring at the moment. I probably should be at home. I should pick my son up from school.
Yeah,
you know. It's all of that, those kind of things.
Those things are very important, and
I felt much the same when I worked with Sue Pollard. Still one of my favourite moments. I did the play was called That Showbiz, and it was written by Jimmy Perry. And on the first night, on the run through, it turned out it was about 6.5 hours long. And so they had to cut it very, very quickly. So no one knew who was on when, which scene had disappeared or whatever. And this wonderful moment, Sue Pollard singing a sad song about love. And that's why he loves me. Fade out, walk off stage. Where's my fucking costume? Still mic'd up. An absolute delight.
Ladies and gentlemen, he's worked with them all, from Sue Pollard.
Yeah, I wish I hadn't said the bit at the end, because it now looked like I was showing off, but it was meant to be, but it's cut that bit.
No, no way.
No.
No, I'm going to, if we cut it, I'm going to get everyone in the audience just to tell everyone that they said it. Which bit do you want to cut?
Just the bit about, because now it feels like being a wanker, just going, I was in an amazing place and I met some...
Well, if we do cut it, Ben will be glad, because it's near the end. So right. He's very lazy.
Yeah.
It makes it easier for him. If you said,
I kept it all secret for ages. So that night, I wanted to fucking tweet. I'm in Beverly Hills. I've just been in the Hollywood fucking Hills. I sat there and I watched Jeff Lynne and Eric Idle play the banjolele while Steve Martin applauded, right? And none of them knew that George Formby was given the Order of Lenin by Stalin. So those, you know that bit where you go, I don't know what I've got to add to this. I wonder if Steve Martin, the banjolele fan, knows that George Formby was given, and that's genuinely true, the Order of Lenin by Stalin. He also didn't know that John Paul Sartre had very, very beautiful blonde hair. You know that bit where you got emerging, right, I'm with a philosopher, get me Jean Paul Sartre's beautiful blonde hair thing, right? Jean Paul Sartre was a little boy, as you know, not a great face, not a great, you know, but no one realised he had this really lovely curly blonde hair. And then when his mum was out, his granddad went, you look too girlish, we've had enough of this, took him to the barbers, had all his hair cut off, and when his mum came back, she basically went, ah! Right, 7 years, she's gone, my beautiful angel, what the fuck is that? Went upstairs, didn't come down for 2 days, and thus existentialism. So that just...
But now, if we have to cut the other bit, we can't put that bit in either. So you haven't been very helpful, Robin.
No, I make it more difficult. Which is, make it more difficult for 25 years.
So we're not going to cut it. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a massive round of applause for Robin Ince. You have been listening to Richard Herring's Let the Squad Theatre Podcast with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Robin Ince. The music, as always, is by Pest, if you can call it music. It's just bang, 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 as far as I can hear. Thank you to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre and Go Faster Strike for all their assistance in making this. Also, thank you to our producer, Ben Walker, who I'm very indebted to. I'm also indebted to Ian Messiter, the creator of this podcast from its early days in the 1950s. This is a GoFasterStrike.com Fuzz and Sky Potato production for the internet. Hey there, thanks for watching this week's episode of Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre Podcast. There's no more of it. If you don't want to see me speaking anymore, don't watch this bit. This is just me doing some speaking. If you don't like that, don't watch this bit. That's just to help you out, you people at home. This week's episode has been partially sponsored by Jean Power, or Jean Power. It could be a French man called Jean, or a UK woman called Jean, or, you know, a UK man called Jean, or a UK or a French woman called Jean as well. I don't know, it could be anything. And it's J-E-A-N Power. And what he or she wants me to say, I'm going to say she. Oh, and Mitch, I know all about you. If you've enjoyed these, go to gofasterstrike.com/badges. You can pay £1 a month or just a one-off donation or more than £1 a month and help us make more internet content. You can buy a DVD at gofasterstrike.com. Go to richchang.com/gigs and you can find out where I am gigging and come to London. Here's the Leicester Square Theatre to see me do one of my 12 shows that I'm doing throughout August and September here. Or come and see one of the Leicester Square Theatre podcasts. LeicesterSquareTheatre.com for all the information about that as well. I am indebted to the following people who helped us to pay for filming the podcasts. They are Matthew Smith, Ewan Duncan, Rob Applin, Darren Foote, Colin Anderson, Raymond Harpany, Kevin Tipcorn, Steve Mash, Dean Ratland, Gaynor Wilson, Adam Queck, Stuart Fawcett, Tim Turner, Julian Benton, Thomas Baldwin, Lauren Pilkington, Matthew Blackburn, Neil Martin, Jack Burton, Fraser Levy, Gina Lynn, Paul Jeffrey, Rob Ward, Robert Tang Richardson, Leo Vigoda, Carol Forster, Icky Kawa, Colm McGonagall, Aurora Watters, Jake, Heather Henderson, Simon Carl, Christine Sato, David Collier, Jijin John, Roy Owens, Matthew Poynton, and Ian Seckington, MEP, MEP, could be MEP, or could be Ian Seckington, MEP, if he's an MEP, Richard Grundy, Thomas Phillips, Alex de Jong, Matt Lehe, Alex, Mark Saltmarsh, come off it, Charlie Carrick, and M. Lau, or M. Lowe. Who knows? Thank you to you all. You will be rewarded in heaven, which does not exist.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.